The title is "What Right Wing Social Media Does to You." A year or so ago, I went into a junk shop in Worcester, run by a man probably in his 70s, who straight away started to talk at me about how wearing face masks was a precursor to greater controls. He might have even used the phrase "wake up, sheeple." I wasn't in the mood for this, so I waited for him to take a breath from his diatribe and quickly made my excuses to leave. A few months ago, I was in the gym when a man was saying something, I think, about, I wasn't really listening, to be honest, but he was saying something, I think, about, in his view, how most people are weak when there's that sort of quiet etiquette of waiting for someone else to do something. And he might have even used the phrase, "wake up, sheeple." What struck me in hindsight was that they both had the same way of speaking, clipped, confident, sarcastic, and more than a bit patronising. And I recognised this tone of voice and the tone of what they were saying from various right-wing pundits on social media, such as Lawrence Fox, Andrew Tate, Alex Belfield, and Ben Shapiro. And all of these share a personality type which seems new, or is at least newly visible thanks to social media. There's also the tone of voice among other right-wing personalities, which combines being world-weary with being indignant. And this is shared to varying extents by the likes of Douglas Murray, Donald Trump, Jordan Peterson, Matt Walsh, Tucker Carlson, Nigel Farage, Piers Morgan and Jeremy Paxman. And their manner is less unpalatable in tone of voice anyway, and often appears on the mainstream media. One of the more sort of well-known right-wingers, Tommy Robinson, he's a bit different to the above. His speaking tone is more conversational and less affected, apart from the likely influence of cocaine. And his place in right-wing circles is also a bit different, being more traditionally far right, whereas others I've mentioned can be described as alt-right. There's not a single simple definition of alt-right, as it really encompasses any far-right viewpoint, and the term's more or less just a rebranding of the far-right with an attempt to be new, hip and irreverent, according to anti-fascist researcher Matthew N. Lyons. And none of these right-wing pundits come across as nice people. That's sort of an obvious point, really. You don't expect them to be kind or helpful or relaxing to be around. But they exude confidence, which has become much more important online. The way that sections of the right wing present themselves on social media is almost as important as the content of what they say. The structure of social media platforms shapes how their views are presented and how reactions are made. As Marshall McLuhan said back in 1964, the medium is the message. One platform which many of these pundits have used is the YouTube video. The usual format is that they talk directly to the camera, either jumping around between subjects or with longer conversations or polemics. These approaches are open to anyone, of course, right, left or revolutionary. But right-wing broadcasts often have slicker production values than those of the left. The set design, lighting and editing sometimes isn't too far from that of mainstream TV programmes. And unfortunately, this can add a sheen of authority to the content, which is missing from me at the moment, balancing my mobile phone while I read my notes with the lighting my room turned up a bit. So it looks a bit less like a gloomy flat in Birmingham. These right-wing podcasts tend to criticise left-wing views on culture and identity rather than left-wing views on class or the economy. Sometimes there'll be criticisms of certain types of authoritarianism, such as imposed face mask wearing during the pandemic, and that inspired the man in the junk shop. The stance of many of these podcasters is that, quote, facts don't care about your feelings, unquote, whether or not this is stated explicitly. And this view is that the left prioritises subjective feelings over facts from science or statistics, especially the science or statistics cherry-picked by the right. And the issue where this most often comes up is identity politics, such as the debate about transgender people's identity alongside their biological sex. And the bluntness of the phrase, facts don't care about your feelings, is deliberate, as it reflects the brash and insulting way that the right speaks. I'll give a few examples of this kind of right-wing podcaster, who I came to learn of from their videos popping up whenever I visit YouTube, having found their way to me either through paying to be promoted or due to some sinister algorithm. And of course, the more I click on them as research, the more other ones pop up as well. So much so that, you know, when my YouTube algorithm isn't full of videos of 70s and 80s music or 70s or 80s TV programs or 70s or 80s anything, it's full of these right-wing podcasts. One example is the podcast of the Lotus Eaters, a channel which usually takes the form of a conversation between two pundits. They discuss current affairs from the stance of defending what they would say are traditional moral values. A frequent topic is perceived threats to English culture from communities with origins overseas. And I mean, you could sort of pick any example from their dozens, if not hundreds, of videos. And so one video shows their typical approach. It starts by showing a leftist meme saying that everyone, black or white, has the same colour blood. But that leads the pundits on to saying that black people are less likely to donate blood, in their view. And then they discuss how the left either ignores or celebrates biological differences between demographic groups, depending on what's convenient for their ideology. Many of their videos combine criticism of wokeism, in inverted commas, with defending what they would see as libertarian white English culture. Some of their videos are behind a paywall, and I expect these contain more extreme content. So, you know, that they lure people in with their videos, and those who are hungry for more rabid right-wingness can then pay money for the privilege of listening to it. And on the podcast of the Lotus Eaters, the smugness of the right is expressed through blokey banter, which disguises the prejudice behind it. Sydney Watson's videos also discuss varieties of left-wing ideology. One example is her criticising someone who posted online their views that white-owned restaurants shouldn't serve food from non-white cultures because this is cultural appropriation. That's the kind of sort of thread that she tends to follow. Another discusses movie remakes when characters have been changed to, quote, push woke or feminist narratives, unquote, such as by characters being what's called race swapped, again in inverted commas. Her videos have some research behind them, and her style is very natural, with jokey asides to punctuate her points. But while the extreme left-wing views that she criticises are worthy of critiquing, you know, such as any view is, she does so from a conservative viewpoint to defend traditional values. Someone called Isaac Butterfield's videos take a similar approach, but in a much noisier and more sweary way. Some YouTube channels are just a pundit giving a commentary to a collection of brief videos of people talking about their gender identity, often from TikTok. Someone with the name of Odin's Men is one of these, with him offering dry critiques of people talking about being non-binary. And he sometimes adds that his full views are available elsewhere behind a paywall, as YouTube won't allow them. These pundits all share the world-weary, indignant tone of voice I mentioned earlier. The other tone of voice, the clipped, confident one, is probably more common, associated with particularly prominent characters like Andrew Tate, Ben Shapiro, and Alex Belfield, before his career ended when he was in prison for stalking. And a variation of this tone of voice is found with Leo Kerr's and Paul Joseph Watson, and both of those two broadcast videos of themselves talking direct to camera with occasional clips of what they're talking about. And they use a more facetious, informal tone, occasionally ending sentences with an exaggerated whine drawl inflection. And their style is to mix criticism with just taking the piss. And these videos, of course, come with comment threads, which reduce discourse to short, pithy statements of various depth. And, you know, any video or meme or comment triggers off sprawling threads of responses, as we know. And you don't have to look far to find people who enjoy trolling or commenting to bait people, deliberately provoking argument or an emotional reaction. And trolls don't necessarily believe what they post, as their aim is largely to cause drama. And the kind of people who do this use the anonymity and distance which social media affords, at the same time as the ability to reply directly to others. And I suspect many comments are produced in troll farms. And these are government-run institutions which employ people to post online comments specifically to spread propaganda and division and attack critics or those living in enemy states. So the complicated, confusing nature of social media discourse has been illustrated recently by comments about the allegations of sexual abuse made against presenter and writer Russell Brand. He made his name quite a few years ago with the persona of a loud, libidinous wildcard before he turned to left-wing views and then towards conspiracy theories about COVID and the war in Ukraine. And his shift rightwards was accompanied by a growth in followers on his social media accounts. And when the accusations were made public, YouTube demonetized him, meaning that he can't make money through his channel there, which right-wing commentators have seen as a dangerous example of cancel culture. Conspiracy theories about Brand have also flourished, such as that he's been targeted because he's criticised the mainstream narrative about COVID, with pharmaceutical companies in league with journalists to discredit him. And this kind of right-wing commentary tends to downplay or doubt the women who have reported that Brand sexually abused them. The mainstream social media platforms have policies about what content can be posted there, and users can be banned if they are deemed to violate them. Some conspiracy theories risk being banned, but more likely are posts which promote violence and hatred. Around 2018 and 2019, some prominent activists were barred from the usual platforms, including Britain First, a fascist party formed by ex-members of the BNP, Tommy Robinson, and American radio presenter and owner of website InfoWars, Alex Jones. Most famously, Donald Trump was banned from mainstream platforms in January 2021 for posts deemed to incite violence and spread conspiracy theories about election integrity around the time of the Capitol riots. Removing much far-right discourse from mainstream social media created a gap in the market, which was filled by the growth of other social media platforms. Trump and the others and all their followers wouldn't want to remain silenced, so they flocked to platforms which became known as alt-tech for their popularity among the alt-right. Someone called Joe Mulhall, who's a researcher for the anti-racism organisation Hope Not Hate, identifies two types of alt-tech platforms, those which have been co-opted by the far right because of their minimal content moderation, such as DLive and Telegram, and those which have been created by people with far-right leanings, such as BitChute, Gab and Parler. And each of these platforms is a counterpart to one of the mainstream varieties of social media, with Twitter analogues being particularly numerous. I realise that I should call Twitter X now, but... well, it's a daft name, and as I've mostly been talking about the platform before the name change, I'll stick with Twitter when I mention it, like here. An early alternative to Twitter was Parler, launched in 2018, and after reports that Parler was used to coordinate the storming of the US Capitol, it was blocked by tech firms hosting it, such as Apple, Google, and Amazon. And before Parler went offline in January 2021, it reportedly had about 15 million users. It went back online some months later, but closed again in spring 2023 when it was bought out by another company. Another alternative to Twitter is Getter, founded in July 2021. And its stated aims include, quote, fighting cancel culture, promoting common sense, defending free speech, challenging social media monopolies, and creating a true marketplace of ideas, end quote. And it was established by one of Trump's former aides. And Trump himself launched his own site just a few months later, called Truth Social. Elon Musk chipped in and said that Truth Social is a terrible name, and a better one would be Trumpet, which has got a bit of wit behind it. But that comment helped raise Truth Social's profile. This summer, there were around 2 million users of Truth Social, which is still a tiny amount compared to Twitter's 450 million. And Truth Social's popularity is limited because it tends to attract American Republican supporters, especially men aged 18 to 34. Other demographic groups, such as women and teenagers, are less likely to use it. Other platforms include one called Rumble, which is similar to YouTube, but with content likely to be of interest to American conservatives. Research from early 2022 found that of the 2% of Americans who regularly got their information from Rumble, three quarters identify as Republicans or are Republican leaning. 4chan is one of the platforms which has been co-opted by the alt-right rather than created by them. And this site is used for posting images with some discussion boards, such as one called Politically Incorrect, where posts tend to be racist, sexist, and blatantly neo-Nazi. Despite advocating free speech, alt-tech platforms may have content moderation policies which exclude liberal or left-wing views. And this creates an echo chamber where similar right-wing views bounce and feed off each other. Echo chambers aren't limited to the right, of course, and any group can end up reinforcing its own views if they aren't around alternative ones. But right-wing pundits spend so much of their time attacking what can broadly be described as wokeism, that they're not just reacting to the left, but also that they themselves are a reaction to the left. They need trans activists and feminists in order to exist. And they also need followers on their social media channels in order to attract income. And their views have struck a chord with enough people also reacting against the left. And some sections of the left associated with identity politics could be accused of demonizing men, especially white, straight, cisgender men, when they are focused on concepts like patriarchy, colonialism, and white supremacy, without placing them in a wider societal context. This approach blames masculinity in itself for most of society's problems, rather than how society has moulded masculinity. And some interpret the left's emphasis on struggles of women or trans people or non-white people as dismissing issues such as male loneliness or the higher rates of homelessness or suicide among men. And I realise that all of this is a simplistic generalisation of the left, but as this is the overall perception generated by what's called wokeism, this is sort of the point. It's the phenomenon of wokeism rather than the sort of the drilling down into sort of more considered non-right ideology, which has alienated some teenagers and young men, and some of whom have wanted to reassert masculinity as a way of fighting back, hence them turning to right-wing pundits on social media. And this point was made by the mostly level-headed liberal podcaster, Shoe on Head. Her channel's, yeah, that's the only one I'd sort of say is worth watching. She's not right wing. She's not really left wing either. She's something between, more left leaning, but with a bit more sort of a considered distance. And she said that when the left is interested in men, it just wants to recruit them rather than help them with their problems. And her video about this met with a lot of negative reactions about men from trolls, which sort of reinforced her point. And again, I'm wondering how many of those negative reactions were produced by trolls or troll farms. Someone who illustrates much of what I've discussed is Andrew Tate. And I'll sort of round off by talking a bit about that piece of example of humanity. Andrew Tate used to be a professional kickboxer, but became more famous for his social media use. He initially became known among online far-right circles through his appearances on news website InfoWars, and he then built up his own followers on social media. By July 2022, Andrew Tate's name was being searched on Google more times than both Donald Trump and COVID-19. And his videos on TikTok have been viewed over 12 billion times. And he comes across as very confident, not just in his precise, forceful way of speaking, but also in his ostentatious displays of his wealth. And a typical pose is of him wearing a dressing gown, dark glasses, and smoking a cigar. He describes himself as a libertarian, although his opinions are usually proudly misogynistic. He gained notoriety on social media for promoting an ultra-masculine, ultra-luxurious lifestyle, according to a BBC News article from June this year. Tate has variously been banned and unbanned on Twitter. He's currently back on Twitter and often posts blunt, would-be empowering statements such as, quote, "Realise you have only ever lived at 3% of what's possible," end quote, and another quote, "I will use my bare hands to strangle space-time itself," end quote. Although I do wonder if they're sort of generated by some sort of Andrew Tate bot or something, because they sound more parody than real. But maybe that's telling in itself. He's been permanently banned from Facebook and Instagram for violating their policies on dangerous organisations and individuals. And he's been barred from TikTok and YouTube for similar reasons. Despite the bans, Tate's content continues to circulate on these channels through fan accounts. And Tate himself moved to alt-tech platforms Getter and Rumble. In December last year, Tate addressed the environmentalist Greta Thunberg in a tweet extolling his carbon-emitting automobiles, and he asked for her email address to give her more information. Thunberg replied with the fake email address, smalldickenergy@getterlife.com, and this exchange received substantial attention on Twitter, with Thunberg's report quickly becoming one of the most liked tweets ever. But you could say there's no such thing as bad publicity, as of course all this gave more publicity to Tate and probably reinforced his followers' devotion of him. However, in Romania, he's currently being investigated for charges of rape, human trafficking, and forming an organised crime group to sexually exploit women, which reveals his misogynistic leanings. Campaign group Hope Not Hate carried out some research on Tate's popularity. And this showed that overall, three quarters of young men had seen content by him, more than who would have seen content from the likes of Tommy Robinson or Nigel Farage. Half of young men have a positive opinion of him and his opinions, while 8% of young women have a positive opinion of him. And the subgroup of people which has the most support for Tate is Muslim males aged 16 to 24. Tate himself converted to Islam after previously being a Christian and an atheist. And when those who held a positive view of Andrew Tate were asked why they felt that way, The most popular reasoning given by his fans was that Tate, quote, wants men to be real men, unquote. 30% of Tate's fans believe that catcalling women on the street is not wrong at all, while the same proportion believe that it isn't wrong to share intimate photos sent to you by a romantic partner with a friend. And lots of teachers have reported to Hope Not Hate that ever greater numbers of mainly boys were using Tate's misogynistic rhetoric against girls in the classroom. And unfortunately, that's often spilled over from talk into sexual abuse. But by presenting himself as living a wealthy lifestyle, at least before he went to prison, he made the connection between success and misogyny. And that's had an influence. Some of his popularity is down to him being perceived as a maverick. And I think that also applies to Russell Brand. And people who stand out like that seem to attract support regardless of how reasonable or responsible they are. Also shown by Boris Johnson and Donald Trump reaching the positions that they did. So to sum up, the culture of right-wing discourse on social media has been shaped by two things, at least two things. The various formats of social media, especially the tailored alt-tech ones, and also reacting against the strand of leftism characterised as wokeism. And this has enabled the rise of a breed of articulate and media-savvy pundits and their millions of online followers. But the important thing is that their ideology is based on hatred, whether misogyny, racism or transphobia, however much this gets glossed over by banter and snappy editing. Thank you.